The first criminal charges against Bill Cosby are moving closer to trial. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Following a preliminary hearing today in Norristown, a judge found that the charges will not be tossed out. It comes after Cosby's attorneys delayed the key hearing for months and tried to derail the case, as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Some observers were expecting accuser Andrea Constant to take the stand. Instead, a former police detective did, recounting what Constant had told police a year after the 2004 alleged sexual assault. Cosby's attorney, Brian McMonagle, said in his 30 years of practicing law, he's never seen the accuser skip taking the stand during a preliminary hearing. McMonagle called the detective's testimony secondhand, tantamount to hearsay. But the judge said it was fine. After the hearing, Montgomery County DA Kevin Steele agreed.
Hearsay is admissible, and we're just over the next hurdle in this.
And it's a pretty significant hurdle to clear. The preliminary hearing is usually a time for the defense to poke holes in a case. For prosecutors, it's a time to beat back the defense without exposing too much of their evidence, says attorney Stephen Gaudet. He was watching the hearing but isn't involved on either side.
And it always is a tug of war because naturally the defense wants to use the preliminary as an opportunity for a number of things. One, to establish the record, take shots at the preliminary hearing early on to see if they can knock out charges at that early stage.
Two former police detectives who worked on the Constant case and a police chief took the stand. Most of what came out was already known, but it was the first time full police statements were read, adding new details. Like after she took pills Cosby gave her, Constant told police her legs felt rubbery, her vision was blurred, and she thought about calling 911. She next awoke at 4 a.m., with her bra undone and feeling like she had been violated. Attorney Gaudet said, even though Cosby's defense attorney got shut down by the judge when trying to question the witness, it gave the public a preview of what to expect at trial.
In this scenario, obviously credibility is going to be everything in the end of the day. But by law, it's not at the preliminary hearing.
Cosby's next hearing, an arraignment, is scheduled for July 20th, but he won't have to appear. A trial date has not yet been set. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
A plan in Harrisburg to legalize ride-hailing services Uber and Lyft in Philadelphia is moving forward. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the way in which taxes produced by those businesses would be distributed has some school supporters crying foul.
The Philadelphia Parking Authority already regulates taxis and limousines in the city, so adding Uber and Lyft is not a stretch. Authority head Vince Fennerty says the services have won business away from taxi drivers even while operating illegally.
The medallion owners didn't see what was changing and respond to it. Business as usual. And guess what? Everyone I know, I don't know anyone that really doesn't like the convenience of an Uber or a Lyft.
City Councilwoman Helen Gim showed up at the PPA monthly meeting complaining that the proposed plan would have the authority taking money that should help the school district.
The point is that there's a new revenue stream opening up. It should go towards Philadelphia kids, and instead it's being rediverted back away from school kids and into the parking authority's coffers. We're seeing declining revenue from a massive profit-generating agency for school kids on a consistent basis. It's not acceptable, and we're going to push back on it.
Uber and Lyft have thousands of independent contractors that will have to undergo screenings and car inspections if the state bill goes through, and that's expected to cost up to $4 million to administer, says Fennerty. He says that has to come from the taxi and limo division, not from other things the agency manages.
We can't use the money from garages or from red light camera or from on street. They're each set up different business entities by statute, ordinance, or agreement.
City Deputy Managing Director Brian Abernathy says he worked as a mediator between state officials and the parking authority.
The parking authority has to have enforcement mechanisms, and in order to have those mechanisms, they have to pay for them. They think that's in the $4 million range, and that was exactly what they wanted to see prior to seeing funding go to the school district.
Abernathy says after the first 2 years, there could be money available for education. Education supporters say they aren't giving up on what they consider a new source of revenue. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
A controversial $400 million project to deepen the Delaware River's shipping channel will conclude next year. Last night, we heard about the project's environmental impact and concerns it could worsen the effects of sea level rise on the watershed. WHYY's Katie Culinary now looks at whether the investment will pay off for the region's ports and the local economy.
On a recent afternoon, local politicians and business leaders gathered at the Packer Avenue Marine Terminal in South Philadelphia. Standing in front of a giant blue and white crane used to lift containers off cargo ships, U.S. Senator Bob Casey told reporters he's confident Congress will approve the last chunk of federal funding needed to deepen the Delaware shipping channel this year.
It's a great sense of satisfaction because it allows this region to be much more competitive and really to chart its own course for the future.
That course for the future is the promise of lots of good-paying jobs. The project to dredge the river to a depth of 45 feet was held up for nearly three decades by state officials across the river in New Jersey and Delaware, who didn't think it was worth spending millions in taxpayer dollars. In Pennsylvania, politicians and business leaders argued that without a deeper river, ports in the region would lose out to other East Coast cities.
Senator, welcome to the Packer Avenue Marine Terminal as well.
After the press conference, Casey got on a bus with Leo Holt, whose family operates the Packer Avenue Terminal, for a tour.
It's perfect visual. This ship right here is a Monty-class ship.
Holt pointed out the window at a large cargo vessel and explained that ship can hold about 5,500 TEUs. That's shipping jargon for containers.
This is old technology. The new generation of ships that these people have are 9,000 TEUs.
Right now, those big ships can't make it down the Delaware River. And that's a problem for Holt and his workers, because more of those larger vessels will be heading to the East Coast once the Panama Canal is expanded later this year. Ports in other cities like New York and Baltimore have already deepened their shipping channels, so people like Holt have been feeling the pressure.
We have been behind the eight ball and behind the curve.
Boosters say that's about to change. According to the Maritime Exchange, that's the Delaware River's Chamber of Commerce, deepening the channel will increase the amount of cargo coming into ports in the region by 2.5 million tons every year. And more cargo means more good-paying union jobs to unload it. But the Philadelphia Regional Port Authority, which has chipped in about a third of the cost, is cagier about the economic projections and can't say exactly what kind of new business it could tap into when the project is finished.
But here's what I can tell you.
Don Brennan is the authority's director of government and public affairs.
I'm going to go across the hall to the marketing guys. There's three or four of them there. And they're going to be able to go out and see an account that they couldn't see last year because that account needed 45 feet of water. And they're going to be able to go out there and they're going to be able to talk to them now. And that is all we want. Position us to be more successful than we are.
But Brennan admits competition among East Coast ports is fierce, and Philadelphia is still going to have to fight hard to convince shippers to bring their cargo here, as opposed to, say, New York or Baltimore. Adi Tomer is a fellow with the Brookings Institution who studies transportation. He says it could be a generation before we find out whether this investment pays off.
And it very well may have little to do with the depth of the channel there, as much as it does with commodity demand, supply as well, and how folks end up shipping goods between markets and whether Philadelphia makes sense to grow their piece of the pie.
In other words, it might not matter that Philadelphia's channel is deep enough to welcome these big ships filled with cargo containers if people in the region don't want to buy what's in those containers, or if shippers can get a better price in another city. So Brennan's marketing guys are going to have to sell Philadelphia's other assets like access to highways and railroads and a flexible labor force that can load and unload ships more quickly. 6 years ago, after nearly three decades of lawsuits and interstate fighting, the Delaware Deepening Project got underway without so much as a ribbon cutting. Brennan says it'll be different when the project is finished next year.
It should be the largest party held at the Port of Philadelphia in 40 years.
But when the party's over, that's when the real work begins. Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Still ahead. You grow a garden on vacant land and then the owner comes back. What to do? Well, if you're anything like this guy, you fight.
I remember telling them flatly, we don't accept that. Like, I see that y'all got plans to build right there, but that's unacceptable. Peace Park is there, so y'all not going to be able to build there.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. It happens all the time. A vacant lot in a city becomes a dumping ground and languishes for years. Somebody decides to fix it up, grow a garden, open a little shop. Years pass, and then the owner comes back. Should those who've been tending the land have any rights to it? Well, a group of gardeners in North Philadelphia thinks they should, and they're pushing back on a huge redevelopment plan by the city's public housing authority. Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra has the story.
Tommy Joshua is working in the garden when this guy rides by and gives him some bad news.
Some dude, some like arbitrary man, riding by on a bike from the neighborhood, see me out there, told me straight up, yo, dog, they got a plan to like take this whole joint over. Yo, you doing all this in vain.
It's 2014, and over the last couple years, Joshua and his friends have turned some vacant land in one of the highest crime, poorest neighborhoods in Philadelphia into a community garden. It's about as big as a few basketball courts, and they call it the Peace Park. Now, what this guy's telling him is that the land is about to get swept up in this $500 million redevelopment plan by the city's housing authority. So Joshua goes to a community meeting to see if that's true. At the front of the room, there's a glossy cardboard map showing the first phase of development.
I'm looking at it and I'm saying, hold up, that's the Peace Park. But it was like something else over the Peace Park.
He goes home, tells the other gardeners, and they show up to another meeting. This time, with vegetables.
I remember telling them flatly, we don't accept that. Like, I see that y'all got plans to build right there, but that's unacceptable. The Peace Park is there, so y'all not going to be able to build there.
So launches a standoff, with Joshua and the Peace Park on one side and the Housing Authority on the other. A standoff that raises a question. Who owns the land in a community? Sharswood has been a mostly African-American neighborhood for a while. And back in the 60s, tensions between police and the community led to riots. A lot of people who could afford to leave did. After that, Philadelphia's Housing Authority built the high-rise public housing towers, and the neighborhood fell into decline. Kelvin Jeremiah became the head of the agency in 2013. He says he visited the towers late one night to see what life there was like.
I left, frankly, feeling scared for my life.
Jeremiah says he saw people trying to sell drugs, and that a guy lifted his shirt to show him a gun and told him to leave.
No, I was only there for maybe 4 or 5 minutes. We have 500 families there. What about those folks who call it home?
Around that time, the agency came up with a plan to turn the neighborhood around. It would build apartments, bring in businesses, and even reopen a local school. But before that plan existed, Tommy Joshua was trying to fix this neighborhood from the ground up. He's 36, and he grew up in Sharswood. So a few years ago, when he looked at this huge piece of land across from the towers, he knew it had been vacant for decades. He says it looked and smelled like a dump, piled high with old furniture and garbage.
It was almost like having a big trash heap in front of your house.
Joshua and some friends decided they'd had enough. They spent weeks clearing the trash. And then they grew a garden in the shape of a peace sign, with plants like tomatoes, peppers, onions, and kale. The closest supermarket was a mile away, so the gardeners gave the food away to their neighbors. Little by little, kids from the neighborhood saw the gardeners out there, wearing boots and paint-splattered pants, pushing around wheelbarrows and planting, and they started pitching in.
I think kids naturally like to play, and the type of creative work that we do with ecology, I think to them it would look like play.
Joshua and some of the other gardeners were teachers, so they turned the park into a sort of outdoor classroom. Here's Joshua that first season. He's talking to a middle school-aged boy who's wearing a yellow Old Navy sweatshirt and sitting in the passenger seat of a pickup truck.
Now, why should we eat vegetables?
Well, we can all get strong and have good eyesight and be smart and get energy.
You said it all.
And get tall.
You said it all, yeah.
They made the program official, built a schoolhouse from old tires and concrete, and used their own money to hire more teachers. They held classes in art, ecology, music, and architecture for more than 160 kids. And then in 2014, Joshua found out the Housing Authority owned part of this land, and it was going to seize the rest and build affordable housing. The gardeners had no legal rights here, but they decided to stay and fight the plan anyway. In part two of this story, we'll tell you how they did it, and how, from the perspective of the Housing Authority, which was trying to save this neighborhood after all, the gardeners looked a lot like trespassers.
I would have some issue with anyone going onto someone else's property and saying, despite your plans, I have a better idea for it.
Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Join us for part two of the series on tomorrow's show. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Philadelphia is poised to join Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., cities where consumers can avail themselves of a pro-labor business guide. Labor 411 has begun publishing a Philadelphia edition online and will appear in print in time for the Democratic National Convention here at the end of July. Joining me is Sherry Senders, publishers of Labor 411, and Patrick Iding, president of the Philadelphia Council of the AFL-CIO. Sherry, Patrick, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us here.
Sherry, starting first in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and then Washington, I might surmise that now Philadelphia of the four is the most sympathetic to union causes and union-based based on its legacy. Is that so?
Absolutely. And we're very excited to be here for the DNC and to really help get our message out to a broader consumer movement.
And so describe the guide.
So we're a consumer guide that is about creating good jobs. So there's lots of jobs that have been created since the recession, but we really want good quality jobs. So we want to have a lot of the manufacturing jobs, the reshoring jobs. We want to make sure that they're good jobs that help build up our community.
And Patrick, how will this site be a driver to consumers?
Our idea is twofold. One is to get folks who come here who may have a union bias to frequent those venues that do treat their workers well and have a collective bargaining agreement, and also to let the world know that most of the time when we're on the news, it's because we're fighting some contractor or some act that's going on or not going on. And here we have an opportunity to show all the great employers that we have a partnership with.
Sherry, is it your hunch that the message and mission of Labor 411 is made easier because we are now substantially emerged from the depths of the recession 2008?
Absolutely.
In terms of consumer buying power?
Absolutely. Consumer buying power. The jobs have not yet returned. So many of our community partners are really still suffering. I mean, we still have a lot of workers that are really working in subsistence jobs. And so we really need to be fighting for good jobs. And that's where Labor 411, we believe, can come in by really allowing people to live their values with every dollar they spend. Every time they open their wallet, they can make a difference in their community and help create a stronger America just by the choices they make.
Listeners of a certain age will recall Cesar Chavez and the California fields and trying to unionize those workers and then educate and inform consumers to consider purchasing union grapes, as I recall. Is what's old new again?
You know, the millennials are yearning for meaning and to find a path forward. With income inequality such a defining issue of their time, they're really trying to figure out where they want to put their money, where they want to put their resources. And all study after study shows that these millennials care about where they spend their money, and they're spending it in sustainability, and we want them to have one more tool in their toolbox, which would be about good jobs, helping create good jobs.
Even, Patrick, if those millennials ultimately work in fields that are non-union, do they still have that mindset, do you believe?
I think they will. I think you referenced a great labor movement and a great accomplishment for folks who need it the most. And we have it right here on the East Coast and across the whole country with the fast food workers. I mean, those folks that are working for McDonald's and Burger King, they're getting fired because they're standing up for their rights. And their slogan is $15 and a union now. If Chavez was here right now, he would say, let me put my arms around them and help them. That's the kind of stuff I think is coming out. And I think the millennials that we're talking about, that they can relate to that.
Sherry Senders, Patrick Iding, thanks so much for joining us on
Newsworks
Tonight.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
Sherry Senders is publisher of Labor 411, establishing first online in Philadelphia and then a print version just in time for the Democratic National Convention in late July. Patrick Iding is president of the Philadelphia Council of the AFL-CIO. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Let's start the union, call it every human. And finally this evening, asking someone if they're a pork roll or a Taylor ham, well, that could get you slapped, unless they're from New Jersey. The two names for the same processed pork product have pitted Garden Staters against each other for years. And a new Rutgers-Eagleton poll on the issue does little to settle the matter. The poll shows most North Jersey residents, 59%, call it Taylor ham. 65% of South Jerseyans say pork roll. As for the elusive Central New Jerseyan, Well, he can be spotted mostly alongside his southern neighbor, with 45% calling it pork roll, just 25% saying Taylor ham. We're saying goodnight. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.